Hey, welcome in to this edition of All Ball. All basketball, all the time. Last week we brought you two guys who I really, really respect in terms of their knowledge of college hoops and the NBA and all that's going on, Andy Katz and Jeff Goodman. You can download that. What all of this new stuff means. This week, a little bit different. Charles Barkley, Sir Charles, the Hall of Famer, who of course works for Turner, and that's Turner Broadcasting, NBA TV and TNT, and their partnership with CBS in the NCAA tournament, as well as covering the league. I mean, do I really need to introduce him? Like, it's like dumb to do so. We had a long talk. It was about an hour and, I don't know, 10 minutes long or so. So buckle up. We bounced around. We talked a lot about him, his upbringing, him playing at Auburn. He actually shared with us a story. He said he'd never shared elsewhere, ever shared elsewhere, about almost not going to Auburn. Wait till you hear where he almost went. That's a tease to make you keep listening. A reminder, we have interviews like this daily on the Doug Gottlieb Show. That's a national radio show, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, every day on Fox Sports Radio. You can listen to that on the iHeartRadio app, on foxsportsradio.com, or the same XM Sirius channel that Dan Patrick is on. It's a 203 and 217 Sirius XM. 203 and 217. Anyway, here's me catching up with one of the all-time great players and probably the greatest studio analyst of all time, Charles Barkley.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Charles, when you thanks so much for taking time. First and most importantly, how's your health?
I'm great, brother. I'm great. I wasn't feeling well one day. I took the test. It took forever for it to get back, but I'm doing great. Just a little bored. So just wishing everybody out there the best, man. It's an awful situation with the health and financially, so bless everybody out there.
If you were in charge of the NBA, what would you do? Like, as of today, you can't go back. It's May 6th. The teams that weren't competitive, they don't want to put their guys out there when they're not going to fill up their arenas. The teams that were competitive probably want to get this thing in. If you're in charge, Charles Barkley is the commissioner. Everybody has to do what you say. What do you do?
Well, I'd get the players, obviously the commissioner and the TV networks together and say, guys, this is the deal. The owners, they own these teams forever. We're going to be broadcasting games when all you guys retire. We're going to have to bite the bullet. We're going to pay you guys for this season, and you're not going to play basketball for the rest of this year. It's not safe for the players. It's not safe for your family. And we appreciate all what y'all do, but it's best that we don't play basketball this year. That, to me, is the best scenario. Because I think the one thing you cannot happen is, and from a legal standpoint, you can't have one of these players get sick. And God forbid one of their kids, their wives or girlfriends or mother or dad or grandparents die because they passed the virus on. From a legal standpoint, you would be screwed. So I think the NBA, listen, like I say, these owners own these teams. They're going to own them forever. Mm-hmm. We're going to broadcast games at TNT forever. Let's just pay these guys because they tried to play. It's just something unprecedented. And we pick it back up next year.
There's so many different other, I guess the problem with that for TNT and for ESPN is, you know, how badly would that hurt business, right? Whereas when you look at the documentary, the Last Dance documentary, it's one reason it's doing incredibly well. Obviously it's focused around Michael Jordan, but the other is that there's nothing else on and the NBA could capitalize on it. Is there any way in your mind to navigate that and still get this thing done?
Well, there's no way to do it safe. I mean, you know, there's really no way to do it safe. I mean, they tell you if you get tested for this thing, it might not show up for 2 weeks. Let's say hypothetically, you test one of these guys, he's clear, he plays a couple basketball games, he gets his team infected. Like I say, get his wife or girlfriend infected, and God forbid his kids. Yeah. It would be a catastrophe. And listen, I'm very aware. I'm in the TV business, but we just can't make a bad decision because of money. I mean, and that's really what it comes down to. Are we going to make a bad decision just because of money? And I understand there's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I'm very aware of that. But do you make a bad decision for money? And that's and I say no.
Let me get to the Last Dance documentary. I know you've been asked about it a bunch of different outlets, and I appreciate you taking time with me. When you watch it, what are your honest thoughts? What have been your honest thoughts going through your mind?
I don't think there's anything that surprised me. I hope all these young kids out there realize that, you know, you go back to episode 1 and 2, you know, Michael, when he went to Carolina, talked about, I'm going to be the hardest working guy. I'm going to be the best player you ever had. And then even when he went to the Bulls, when he had a chance to, quote-unquote, the way guys do now, like, no, sit out the rest of the season. Like, no, basketball players play basketball. I think that's the one thing these young guys can learn, that, hey, it's great to have a brand. It's great to make a lot of money. But at the end of the day, how great of a basketball player do you want to be? So I think that's the one thing I hope a lot of these young kids get out of this. And also, the only bad thing about this documentary to me is people getting to see all the bad stuff that goes on behind the scenes. I mean, Doug, you think about this. That team won 5 or 6 championships, and they hated each other, and it was strictly business with the front office. It was dysfunctional. And these guys were winning. You hear players talk about all the time, man, whatever happens in the locker room stays in the locker room. That's because a lot of stuff behind the scenes sucks. You know, nobody want to hear a bunch of millionaires and billionaires fighting and not getting along, but that's the way it is behind the scenes. And you're getting a chance to see it firsthand. Well, a team, think about this. That team won 6 championships. Can you imagine all the crap that goes on behind the bad teams? That's what, you know, that's the one thing that I hate that's going to get out. They're like, wait, sports are not, like, it's not all roses and daisies. No, man. It's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. You see the players, you're going to see the players fighting and not getting along. And that's the way, Doug, I've been in the NBA since 1984. I've seen players and coaches fight. I've seen players fight. I've seen players go after general managers. I mean, like, normally that stuff stays in the locker room. But now it's right out there in front of everybody to see.
Let's go back to 84. I've heard so many different. I had Mark Price on my pod. This is 2 weeks ago, and he said, "Look, Charles Barkley was the best player at the trials." One of the things that's missing, and obviously it's not a documentary solely about Jordan or about the 84 Olympic team. Bob Knight was the coach, and Mark Price, you, Terry Porter, like you go through the laundry list of guys. John Stockton, all cut from that trials. What do you remember about going to Bloomington for the 1984 Olympic trials?
Well, Doug, to be honest with you, I was the second best player there. I mean, I appreciate Mark. I love Mark. That's a nice compliment. But let me tell you something that's funny. So, first of all, there's probably about 30 to 40 Hall of Famers who were there. And we started with 120 players, and we have 100. We went 120, 100, 80, 60, 40, 20, and 16. And when I got cut, it was me, Karl Malone, John Stockton, Terry Porter, who rode to the airport together. And the thing that's really funny, and I've told this story a couple times. So my college coach talked me into going to the Olympic trials. I wasn't a big Bobby Knight fan. He says, "Charles, I need you to go because I think you're the best player in the country, and I want you to prove it." And I'm like, "All right, coach, those some kind words." He says, "No, I've been around for years. You're the best. I believe you're the best player in the country." So I go there, and I do my thing, obviously. So John Thompson, who's like the greatest man ever, in my opinion, he calls my college coach right after I get cut. He says, "Son, I just want you to know something. I don't know why Bobby hated Charles Barkley for no reason. He was the second best player here, and he should have made the team." And I said, "Wow, John Thompson, who, like I said, he's a great man. Not a great coach, a great man." And my coach sits me down. He says, "Charles, there's a player in the country better than you?" I said, "Dude, yes, sir, there is. There's this black dude from North Carolina. He's the best basketball player I've ever seen in my life." And I said black, like, because he's dark-skinned. I said,
yeah, yeah.
He's black as hell, but he's the best basketball player I've ever seen. And he said, what's his name? I said, his name is Michael Jordan, coach. And we were there for a couple weeks. And like I say, it's probably 30 to 50 Hall of Famers that was there when this thing started. And I'm like, for a week and a half to 2 weeks, I'm like, damn, I thought I was the best player here, but this dude is scary. And that was my first introduction to MJ. And it was us, the coach, this dude, and there's obviously he's still in college at the time, but the coach, I ain't never seen anything like this cat. He's unbelievable. And obviously the rest is history.
But it is fascinating, though, that like he just Knight didn't like you. Was there something you said? Was there something you did? Like I had been told, like, once around you joked around with him or whatever. I don't know. Was there anything you said or did that could have put you? Because I'm actually reading a story right now from the New York Times. It's available online where it says the talk of the trials is Charles Barkley. That, you know, Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley, the talk of the trials, and it talks about you coming from Auburn and people not knowing who you were. So to go from that, and obviously, like, look, Pat Ewing got cut. I mean, the guys that got cut are amazing. But was there anything that you believe you said or did that would have caused you to be on Bob Knight's bad side?
Absolutely not. You know, obviously, I have great respect for him. You know, I've always respected Bobby Knight because, number one, he graduates players. I never worry about coaches who win. I worry about them graduating their players. And I've always admired him for that. But it was clear to me, just the vibe. Like, all the other coaches were friendly. I was actually roommates with Steve Alford, who's an unbelievable dude. But there was just something about me he didn't like. And like I say, clearly I'm not going to do anything to disrespect Bobby Knight at that time. I'm like a young, stupid kid.
Yeah.
But he had made up his mind. I was not going to make the team. And, you know, I didn't go crazy because I had proved my point, to be honest with you, Doug, because I was trying to decide, was I ready for the NBA, mm-hmm. To be honest. I was trying to decide. And that was my chance to play against a bunch of these household names. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready for the NBA. So I left after my junior year. But that was a really important stepping stone for me in my life to give me confidence because, you know, I'm from a small town in Alabama, and I almost did not go to Auburn. Because, you know, my friends are like, yo, dude, we're from a small town. We're not as good as these guys. And I was actually going to sign with a junior college. I don't think I've ever told anybody that. My mom said, you're not signing with no junior college. You're going to at least go to college and get a free education. Because I wasn't, I mean, obviously, you know, obviously later in life you get your supreme confidence and you turn into a hell of a player. But, you know, you're 18, I'm thinking like, Mom, I'm going to go to junior college. Because nobody in my hometown, you know, there's only a few thousand people there. And we had great sports in all three sports. We had like a really good team all my whole childhood. Not me, but I'm going back too. But we never had any players who went to like Division I. And we had, and so we didn't have that type of confidence. Like, no, I can play in the SEC, or I could play at a big time school. All the guys in my hometown, no matter whether they were good at football, baseball, or basketball, nobody really went to a. I think I'm the first that actually went to a big time Division I school.
Wait. So, but if I remember correctly, okay, and it's Leeds, Alabama, is your hometown. You were a late bloomer, right? You were like 5'10" as a junior, and then you sprouted up to 6'4". So, and that, but did you play inside? Were you always thick, or were you a point guard when you were 5'10"?
Well, I was a backup point guard when I was 5'10", and the best thing that ever happened to me was obviously growing. But also my ability to dribble the ball as a backup point guard, once I got to be 6'4", 6'5", was a huge advantage. Because the one thing I realized, even though all these guys are bigger than me, they can't move. Big guys can't move laterally. They can move one step, maybe two steps. But if you're a big guy, you look at, and I'm not comparing myself to these guys, you look at a guy like Kevin Durant, Dirk Nowitzki, guys like that. If you're a big guy and you can dribble, it's a huge advantage.
I mean, that's really what's changed in the NBA is, you know, well before well before Draymond or any of these guys played, you know, small ball five or whatever, the ability to, you know, if you can get matched up, if you can, you're physical enough to defend a big guy and then take him out in the court, they can't move. They can't move laterally. Wait, so what was the junior college you almost went to?
Sneed State. They had a coach there named, God, I can't even remember his name, Stan Cook. They had a coach there named Stan Cook, who I really liked. And Stan, I went to visit Stan, and I liked him a lot. But then my mom said, no. You go to junior college, you get hurt or something, you're not going to get a free education. So, Stan Cook was the coach's name, and it was Sneed State. Because actually, two of my teammates actually had went there, and that's why I was leaning toward them.
Wow. He's actually in the Alabama Community College Hall of Fame, just so you know.
Oh, he was a great coach. I mean, they won a lot. And like I say, they had got a bunch of players from my high school. So I felt like, so I had known him for a while. So when I went up there to visit, I'm like, man, I can play at this school. Oh, so he's in the Hall of Fame. It's well deserved. He was a hell of a coach and a great guy.
You mentioned that you hadn't met Jordan until the Olympic trials. What was it like for you at Auburn? It's so different now than you know, but to be at a school that's so prestigious in terms of football, what was it like? What was your experience at Auburn like playing for Sonny Smith?
It was great. It was painful in the beginning because, first of all, when you go to Auburn, you got 100,000 fans for football games. You got 3,000 for basketball. I'm like, because like when I played in high school, my junior and senior year, we were packed. I mean, we took a full crowd on the road. So I'm used to playing in front of big crowds. So I go to Auburn, we got 100,000 in their football game, and we got 3,000 to 5,000 at basketball game. Unless we're playing Kentucky or Alabama, it sucked. And I remember during the preseason, we lost, and I started crying. And this is one of the turning points in my life. So we lost, because I only lost like four or five games in high school, my junior and senior year. I think we lost the state championship both years I was in high school. And we lost, and I started crying. It's like we're like eight and nine. You know, you play a little cream puff schedule, and then you start playing the big boys. You know how college works.
Yep.
And we lose a game, and I started crying. And
you lost your first loss was to Tennessee, by the way.
Are you all right? I says, yeah, I'm fine. They said, why are you crying? I said, because we lost. And they said to me, dude, we never win here. And I said, what? And they said, dude, we never win here. We haven't had a 500 record in the last 20 years. And I was flabbergasted. I'm not going to lie. So I went home and just went crazy that night to myself. And I went home the next day. I went to practice. I said, guys, we need to have a sit down. We're not going to keep losing here. I'm not going to stand for this crap. We're going to play better. We can do better. And they look at me like I got three heads. And I said, no. I'm guaranteeing you guys we're going to start winning. And we got to 500 my first year. My second year, we got four games over 500 and almost made the NIT. And then my third year, we made it to the tournament, which is, to me, one of the greatest accomplishments of my life. I'm like, no, we're not going to keep losing. And to get Auburn to the March Madness for the first time, I consider that one of my best results of my life.
When you get to the NBA, to come from Leeds, to go from being 5'10 as a junior, right? The stories of the Scottie Pippins, which is an amazing story, right? Or the Dennis Rodmans, and even Jordan's story of, you know, playing JV as a sophomore, but he was recognized in high school. He was a McDonald's All-American who went to North Carolina. What do you remember about being drafted by the Philadelphia 76ers?
It was one of the best things that ever happened to me because the most important person in my career is Moses Malone. You know, Dr. J was great to me, and Bobby Jones and Maurice Cheeks and Andrew Toney. You know, Doug, one of the biggest problems we have in the NBA today is when you go to a team, the oldest guy on your team is like 23 years old. He, you know, at 23, nobody knows anything, especially how to handle money and fame. Nobody knows how to handle it at 23, 24. But I had all these veteran guys who taught me how to save my money. They taught me how to dress. But the most important person is Moses, because, you know, me and Moses were, he was like a father to me. And I went to his condo one night because he stayed in the same building as me. And I said, Big Mo, why am I? I said, Mo, at practice, can I come see you tonight? He said, come on up, big fella. And I asked him why I wasn't getting to play. And he says, Chuck, you're fat and you're lazy. And I'm like, what do you mean? He says, you're fat and you're lazy. He said, Charles, you weigh about, at that time I'm weighing about 290, 4 or 5, somewhere there, which is what I played. I actually played about 300 pounds in college, to be fair. And he said, Charles, you can get away with that in college, even in high school. You can't play in the NBA at 300 pounds. And this guy, who's obviously one of the greatest, met me every morning, every night, and we started losing weight. I got to 290, 280, 270, 260, 250. I got a little lower, but I had no strength and energy. And he says, 250 is your weight. But you got one of the GOATs of all time, took the time to help a little fat kid from Leeds, Alabama, and the rest is history. I mean, if it wasn't for Moses, I would not have turned into a great player because, you know, Doug, you've been around a long time. You've seen guys eat their way out of the NBA,
yep.
Eat their way out of college. You know, I've been in the NBA since 1984. I can name – I won't name them because I don't want to embarrass anybody, but there's probably 5 or 6 players I played with that probably ate their stuff out the NBA.
I can give you three.
To a veteran guy.
I can give you three names that you don't have to say anything. People forget Stanley Roberts, right? He was one. There was Sean Kemp after the lockout, right? He came. Sean Kemp was one of the best athletes in the NBA. Came back out of the lockout and he wasn't in shape, and it ruined whatever the end of his career was. Oliver Miller would be a guy that would be an obvious guy to point to. There are others as well. I mean, my dad used to tell me, Charles, that like I was in the USBL right out of college. And I was playing with, it was Willie Burton and Bubba Wells and a lot of, you know, Willie Burton scored 50 in an NBA game, right? I mean, he was the 9th pick of the draft. But I remember telling my dad all these guys were NBA players and they're playing, we're like in Enid, Oklahoma. I was like, I cannot believe I'm playing with all these guys. He's like, son, there's always a reason, right? There's a reason why they're not there. I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, why aren't you there? I was like, well, because I can't shoot. Like, all right, well, there you go. You're short, you're white, you can't shoot. That's why you're in the USBL. And then if you go through every guy, and there is always a guy who eats his way out of the league. So how did you do, other than getting up early and conditioning, like, did you eliminate, like, I ain't going to eat pizza, I'm not going to drink? Like, how did you go from 3 bills to 250?
Well, the main thing is working out. I mean, obviously, you can't overeat and go crazy. But you listen, you can't lose weight without working out. You could starve yourself to death, but you need energy. You need energy to play sports. So obviously I'm going to have to eat. But the main thing is, man, once I got one of those checks, I'm like, wait, y'all paying me to do this? I'm like, no, I've got to get in shape. And then obviously I started having success. I mean, I did. I'm like, oh, man, I'm getting good. Because in the beginning, I wasn't starting. You know, I'm coming off the bench and not even playing because I couldn't work hard enough. And Billy Cunningham, who was great for me, like, I'm not going to play you because you're out of shape. But listen, I take it to you, it all goes back to Moses Malone, man. If I didn't listen to this guy. And listen, I don't play with a bunch of guys, not as far as the eating part, but guys who I'm like, yo, man, you got to save your money.
Yep.
You got to learn how to dress. You got to learn how to play the game. I says, part of being famous is like being nice to people just in case you need something from them one day. You know, you heard that famous saying is you better be nice to those people on your way up to the top, because those are the same people you're going to meet on the way back down to the bottom. And a lot of guys, man, they don't understand. I'm like, people said, man, you always sign autographs. I'm like, yeah, I might need a job from that person one day. You always take pictures and sign autographs. I said, yo, man, you never have any idea who you're going to meet in life. So I'm always going to sign autographs. Is it a pain in the ass sometimes? Of course. But I'm always going to sign autographs and take pictures. Because that's part of it, too. I mean, they're not paying you all this money just to play basketball. They're paying you to deal with the whole all the stuff that goes with being in the limelight.
What was your first NBA playoffs? You guys went to the Eastern Conference Finals as defending champions, and you end up losing to the Boston Celtics. What was that? Was prime Bird? What was Bird like?
You know, I've always said Bird was the best at Magic and Bird and LeBron. Those guys are probably the best at making players around them better. You know, Kevin McHale's the best pure player I ever played against personally. I've said that many, many times. But as far as making guys around them better, Bird, Magic, LeBron, those guys are probably the best I've ever seen at making everybody around them better. And Bird's a great dude. He's really quiet. He's not going to be a social butterfly, but I respect that. He's always cordial and nice. Always been like that. But he's not the type of guy who, like, he's going to call and say, "Hey, let's go hang out." That's just not in his demeanor. Now, McHale's different like that. Parrish was like that. But Bird's a lot more guarded.
You mentioned McHale's the best player you ever played against. Why? What was it specifically that when you played against Kevin McHale made him so difficult?
Well, I think, number one, he's unguardable. You know, some guys, even great players, like, okay, we can slow him down. But McHale's going to get his shot every single time. Every time. You just got, like, you try to play him physical, but he's going to get his shot. And there's not many guys who, like, wait a minute, they're going to get their shot. Like, you can make life hard on them. And for me, Kevin McHale, maybe because it was my height and I was just short, but that guy was the best offensive center. I don't think he's better than Tim Duncan. I think Tim Duncan's a better all-around player. But as far as offensively in the post, Kevin McHale is going to get, he's going to get his.
All right, so if he was the best, who's the guy that has the best reputation that really wasn't as good as his reputation?
You know, I don't know about that, Doug, because I don't think. Listen, every NBA player is not great. I say this on air all the time. I'm not dodging your question. Like,
yeah,
the worst guy on an NBA player is a really good player.
Yes.
Now he's not Kobe or LeBron or Michael, but like 10, 11, and 12 is pretty good damn player. And I think that's one of the things that get lost when we talk about sports. Sometimes, like, wait. Yeah, these guys don't get in the game, but they really good players. Now, you talked about earlier what separates some guys. Some guys are 3 inches, 20 pounds, too light to play in the NBA, but they're great backups, and they're never going to cause problems on the bench. That's a lot of things that depend. That's part of playing the game. You give me a guy who's like, okay, this guy, he's a good player, he's solid. He ain't going to cause no problem. He ain't going to be bad-mouthing the coach or complain about playing time. He's going to work hard in practice every single day. But he's probably, like I say, he's probably 3 inches too small, or he's probably not strong enough. And you see guys like that in the NBA today who just going to come in, work hard, practice hard, ain't going to cause no problems. That's a lot easier to deal with than a guy who's got a ton of talent, who don't know he's not that good. He just got a ton of talent, and he's a pain in the ass to deal with.
After the Celtics series, 2 years in a row, I believe you guys lost to the Bucks, and it's like there's so many NBA teams that everybody glosses over. I had Mark on. We talked about the Cavs. People forget those Paul Pressey, Alvin Robertson, Bucks teams were nasty as well. Why couldn't you guys beat the Bucks?
Well, I think two reasons. Number one, we were old, and I wasn't Charles Barkley yet. You know, I started becoming Charles Barkley my third year, and then by that time, Doc, Moses, I think we had traded Maurice, Andrew Tony had retired, and we were just caught in no man's land. When you get too old, brother, ain't nothing you can do. And then, like I say, I wasn't there yet. I was just starting to turn it into Charles Barkley. Moses and Doc were obviously way past their prime. We had traded Maurice, and Andrew Toney was retired. So that's why we couldn't beat them.
What changed? What allowed you? Was it confidence? Was it just the amount of times you'd played? Was it the fact that those guys, the older guys, had kind of given you more shots? Like, what changed that? You know, your third year in the NBA, you lead the league in rebounding, right? You average 23 a game. Obviously, everything seems to change. What was it that allowed that light switch to go on?
Oh, I think, number one, my confidence. You asked the question. My confidence went through the roof. But the main thing, I got myself in, like, I'm at 250, you know, for the next 10 years or more. So yeah. I feel really good about my game. I know nobody can stop me. I'm going to get my 10 to 12, 14 rebounds a night, but I'm going to get 20 to 25, and I'm going to get more unless they double me. And I was feeling like, at that point, I'm full on. I got confidence in myself.
If there's one thing that you want people to know about the Dream Team, what would it be?
Well, how well we all got along together, how friendly everybody was to each other, how much we respected each other. You know, because, Doug, I got a unique perspective. You know, I played in 96, too, and I hated it. You know, I didn't want to play in 96 because I wanted somebody else to enjoy the experience. And Lenny said to me, no, I need you to be a veteran. I need you to be a leader on this team. And dudes were complaining about playing time. Guys were complaining about starting. And it sucked for me, to be honest with you. Like in 92, I'm playing with the best team ever. Guys got along well. Chuck Data had two starting lineups. Nobody ever complained. Nobody ever complained about playing time. But 96, to me, was a nightmare. Like I said, we had guys bitching and complaining, like, I should be starting. I should be playing more. I'm like, yo, man, everybody can't play. You're playing in the Olympics in the United States. But that was the second thing that swayed me. Because obviously I couldn't bring everybody to Barcelona. But being in Atlanta and you know, being from Leeds, which is like 2 hours away from Atlanta, it was really nice for a bunch of my friends and family to be able to come over and see the Olympics in person. I mean, because, you know, it's very rare the United States host the Olympics. So that swayed me for 96. But 96, I ain't going to lie, was a nightmare.
You have unbelievable patience with Shaq and with a lot of people who come at you for not having won a championship. You wouldn't be as great a player as you were unless you were an unbelievable competitor. On the other hand, like, that's the only argument that's ever used against you. When you're look, you do the self-deprecating stuff all the time, but how does it really feel to look back on an incredible career? You recognize you're an Olympian, you're a gold medalist, you're a Hall of Famer, and yet people will, you know, they'll say, well, you didn't win championships. How does that feel inside?
I don't go crazy, man. It's a team game. I understand how fame works. I understand how fame, like, you get all the credit and you get all the blame. I understand that. Doug, I wouldn't be successful in basketball and on TV for 19 years if I didn't understand the BS of the way this thing works.
Yeah.
Guys are not gonna, and this is not a knock, he's just a great friend. It's not going to do any good for you guys to come on TV and radio to talk about Seth Ceballos. You know, you guys, and I'm just naming guys now, you know, you guys never say, man, this guy, I'm trying to, Booby Gibson didn't win a championship. You know, but I understand when you're famous, like a lot of people, you pay a lot of people bills. And I'm the guy that some people take shots at, but I'm like, yo, man, I'm not out here by myself, but I do understand, like, okay, I'm famous. It's for you guys to make money on TV and radio, you got to talk about me. But in retrospect, I said something to you earlier, that's one of the reasons I think they pay you so much money is just to deal with all the BS that you have to deal with.
Right.
And so I don't take it personally. Because, like I say, I knew it was a team game, but I do understand how the whole business model works.
The last thing, and I know you got to go, and you've been more than gracious with your time.
No problem, brother. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, if we can keep going, we'll keep going. You tried it. They tried to do the super team thing in Houston at the end of your career. How did that come together?
You know, I was very disappointed, number one, that the Suns traded me. First of all, we weren't a super team. We were a super old team. We were all past our prime. But I was disappointed that they traded me out of Phoenix. I never wanted to leave Phoenix. But like I say, I had two decent years in Houston. I was done physically pretty much. So I had two decent years in Houston and 2 years that sucked. Hakeem was done, basically. Scottie had a little bit. Well, Scottie actually went on and played some more years, but we were just a super old team. We weren't a super team, but we were all past our prime. And I never wanted to get traded out of Phoenix, in fairness.
It's kind of interesting. You're from Leeds. Obviously, Scottie's from Arkansas. Jordan's from Wilmington. You know, so oftentimes the you know, New York City, L.A., those guys get a ton of the hype. But it is fascinating. Karl Malone from Louisiana, right? Like all these small town kids from the South, and the amount of success that you guys had in the NBA, and still to this day, the South is considered football country, and it is football country. How is it though that so many guys that came from your part of the country have been so dominant in the NBA?
Well, man, it just goes to show you they're great players. I mean, Larry Bird is from Indiana.
Yeah.
French Lick, Indiana. Other than, like, I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed. Who's the second most important person from French Lick, Indiana? You'd be hard pressed to know that. Kevin McHale is from Minnesota. So I just think there's great players everywhere. I really believe that. And like I say, I'm never surprised or shocked. I'm never surprised. Can you imagine that there's a guy as great as Dirk Nowitzki from Germany, Detlef Schrempf from Germany, Tony Parker from France, Ginobili from Argentina, the Gasol brothers. Like, there's just great basketball players everywhere. So I don't think you can be shocked when you're like, oh, he's from this place. I mean, Dirk Nowitzki is the greatest foreign basketball player ever. And he's from Germany. And you're like, wow, that's pretty amazing. I mean, that's really amazing, as a matter of fact.
I actually have an answer for you, by the way. Jerry Reynolds, who used to coach the Kings, the Sacramento Kings, he's from French Lick, Indiana. So I had
to. Hey, first of all, I should jump through the phone and punch you in your head if you're going to claim Jerry Reynolds as a famous person. Now, I love Jerry Reynolds. Hey, I love
you. You just said you'd be hard pressed.
Really, he's been great at the NBA for a long time. I think he's still stealing money during the Kings games.
Yeah.
But we're not going to call Jerry famous. Please stop it.
I understand. You understood the point. That the point was like, Barbara, I was like, just,
I do. I think
you're talking.
I just
typed in French Lick just to see, just for shits and giggles, just to see, and I was like, damn. That's pretty amazing. But you are right.
You want to say one thing about that? Bobby Knight. So he drove me and Larry Bird off. So that's a nice list to be on. To be honest with you, I just thought about that when we started talking about French Lick.
Yeah.
I mean, he. So I'm on the same list with Larry Bird. But it's so funny you said it, though, because nobody ever mentions that. They're like, I've heard people say, well, Bobby Knight didn't take Charles Barkley's crap. I'm like, first of all, I wasn't Charles Barkley at the time at all. I wasn't Charles Barkley at all at the time. But nobody would say, well, he did drive Larry Bird off too. I'm like, yeah, he did, but y'all never want to talk about that. But I always laugh when I hear that.
You know, it's a fascinating point. What's the truth on Isaiah?
I have no idea, Doug, and I'm not avoiding your question. I want to say this. First of all, I like Isaiah. He probably should have been on the Dream Team. Michael Jordan never mentioned that to me. Rod Thorne never mentioned that to me. And I'm disappointed. You know, I've heard some people say some guys on the Dream Team. Well, some guys didn't want him on the Dream Team. They should come forward and say that. But Rod Thorne, when he called me, asked me to be on the Dream Team, never mentioned Isaiah Thomas, ever mentioned Isaiah Thomas. So I just think it's disrespect to Isaiah to act like, because I don't think, I like Isaiah. Was he wrong not shaking the Bulls' hands? Of course he was wrong for not doing that. But every time I get a chance to answer that question, I'm like, I want to make it perfectly clear. They never asked me about Isaiah Thomas, period.
There was a lot of stuff, though, too. There was the Larry would be just another guy if he was a black guy. There was the Magic stuff where they had a falling out as well. You know, and you have to maybe wonder if it wasn't just assumed, right? Like, we just assume
you
guys didn't get
along. Well, I think that also, listen, man, we all say stuff. First of all, I got to say something. I don't agree with Isaiah on the Larry Bird stuff.
Yeah.
But listen, man, I think out of all the bitter battles that they went through and me went through, you're going to say some things in the heat of the moment. Like I say, I'm pretty sure Isaiah regrets not shaking their hands, but we've all said stuff in the heat of the moment. You just lost 6-7 game series of these guys 2 or 3 years in a row, or you got swept or something. I'm pretty sure, you know, because Isaiah Thomas, you got to give that dude credit, man. I mean, he threw that ball away and came back and won a championship after that. I mean, a lot of guys wouldn't have came back from him throwing that ball that Larry intercepted. But I think that we all say stuff in the heat of the moment that we wish we could go back and change, and sometimes you can't.
Yeah, sometimes you can't. It's impossible. It's really impossible to compare eras, right? Because the game is played so incredibly differently now. But is there a guy or two that you say, look, I understand our game was more physical. There was a power forward and a center. And so the space of just getting to the rim and the way in which they play now and the rules in terms of hand checking were different. If you were to say there's a guy or two that their game would absolutely translate to our game when you play in the NBA, who would it be?
Well, obviously, Kobe and LeBron gonna do their thing. First of all, I think all the great players can play in any era.
Right.
I think the thing that's interesting when you talk about different eras, you have to be realistic. Now, you know, we all love Steph Curry, correct? He's a great player and a great man. But from a common sense standpoint, after you watched his Last Dance documentary, you have to say to yourself, man, if the Pistons had been hitting him like that, you know, that would have changed some things up. I mean, you don't even have to, like, I mean, if you're just going to be legitimate and be honest and fair, you got to say, hey, we all love Steph Curry, but if the Detroit Pistons had been hitting him like that, as frail as he is, there would have been like, oh, man, that would have been different. That's not a knock on anybody. That's not a knock on anybody. But from a common sense standpoint, you have to say, yeah, if the Pistons had been hitting him like that, it would have made some changes in his game.
That's totally fair. Listen, when I get roasted to this day because I thought he would be like a Hornacek type, right? Just because he was such a great shooter, not really a point, not really a two. You know, could he really guard somebody with his body coming in? That was my evaluation of him. And it was wrong. Part of it was he's gotten way better. As you said, like I wasn't Charles Barkley. Like he wasn't Steph Curry even early in his NBA career, right? I mean, like it's been well documented that the Golden State Warriors offered him up for trade several times over. So even they didn't know what they had when they had it early on. So, of course, the rest of us shouldn't be faulted if we didn't believe what they had early on or beforehand.
You talk about perception and reality. If you remember, they went crazy in Oakland when they traded Monte Ellis instead of Steph. You know, that's one of the reasons some of this stuff, man, you just have to laugh at because people are so full of crap about. I'm very aware. I'm in the NBA. When people were going crazy, they're like, why didn't you trade Steph Curry? You traded Monte Ellis? But people forget that because, you know, they want to be right in this moment. And Steph is, first of all, he has been amazing. First of all, he's been great for the game. But he's a great player and a great guy. But I always have to laugh that people are like, yeah, you know, all these people who are Steph Curry, wearing Steph Curry jerseys. How many of y'all were actually booing? Because there were a lot of people booing and complaining when they traded Monte Ellis instead of Steph. So you just got to laugh at some of the BS of this whole thing sometimes.
No question about it. Durant's had this kind of mercurial career in terms of talent wise and skill, right? Like that dude is unbelievable. I mean, really, a guy at that size who can, as you pointed out, like early on, we were talking big guys that can, he can handle, he can shoot. He's shown that in Golden State, he can actually defend and defend the rim. Like there's nothing he really cannot do. On the other hand, there just seems to be this unhappiness about him. And I can't figure out why that after winning a couple championships in Golden State, there wasn't more happiness that he's still kind of searching. Why do you think that is?
Well, clearly he's insecure. When you're arguing with teenagers, when you're Kevin Durant, you're one of the greatest basketball players ever. When you're arguing with fools on Twitter, teenagers, to me, that's an insecurity thing. And I don't know where that comes from, because he's a great guy, but clearly he's got thin skin. I don't know where all that comes from, to be honest with you. Because listen, he should be like at peace with himself right now. I mean, because he's already won. He's gonna make more money than God the next 10 years or more. And like, yo, man, you've already won. You know, you've already won. What are you upset about? And you have to. So it's going to be interesting how he handles the whole New York thing. Because I tell people, man, it's going to be interesting how him and Kyrie handle the New York thing. Because that's a different animal right there. New York is a different animal. And it's going to be, I always tell people, oh, no. You guys on the West Coast, that's like that old dude in the White House. The West Coast is fake news. No. Go to New York, Philly, Boston. That's real news. Ain't no fake news coming out of Philly, New York, and Boston. Like when I got traded to Phoenix, and some of the things they wrote, I'm like, man. That's the nicest thing somebody said about me in 8 years. Even if it was bad, it was like the first thing I'd heard. I was like, wow, that's the nicest thing somebody said to me in the last 4 or 5 years in Philly. And there's a double standard, but the East Coast, it's going to be interesting how they handle that whole New York thing.
Yeah, no question. Especially because, I mean, if you really get down to it, the Nets aren't really... They're like the ninth, you know, I think I said like the seventh most popular professional sports franchise. On the other hand, if something goes wrong or they don't do well, and maybe in their need for attention, the negative stories always far outweigh the positive stories. So that's going to be fascinating. I want to go to that Phoenix. Okay, so here's one of my disappointing things with the doc, okay, is that they did talk about your final series, but they just kind of did like the... You know, basically the end of game six and maybe the triple overtime game a little bit. That series is fascinating because the road team won all but one game, right? And this is, and people forget, like this is back in the era where teams always dominated at home. And it was weird. What's missing from the description of the NBA final series against the Bulls?
I did not have my team ready to play game one. The moment was too big for our team, and I take full responsibility for that. You know, it's interesting because when I was watching the documentary, Michael said the exact same thing in game one against the Lakers. That's the only game they lost that series. But he said, man, game one was too big for us. And we've never talked about that, and I did not have my team ready. Even though we had played, I'd been in Philly for 8 years. I'd been in big situations before. That when we got to the finals, it was bigger, and I didn't have my team prepared. And like I say, it was really funny and ironic when I saw Michael say that in the documentary when he says, yeah, game one against the Lakers, the lights were really bright, too big for us. And but I was not able to pull us back because clearly I'm playing against Michael. But that's really my only regret, is not having my team ready for game one.
Game two is a close game. What do you remember?
Every game was close. To be honest with you, every game was close except game one. Game one's the only bad game we played. The other five games could have went either way. And obviously they won three and we won two. But all the games were really, really close games. And I was, and like I say, the only thing I'm mad at and pissed at myself about is, you know, obviously when you got game one at home, you got to win game one at home because that sets the tone for the entire series.
Is there a moment that you look back, you're like, man, if I would have done this one thing, we would have gotten to seven and game seven at home. Is there just not that moment? Just because on the doc you said, look, I played as well as I could, and I just got outplayed by. You don't feel terrible about losing to Michael Jordan, but you're still again a competitor, and it's years later. Is there something like if this would have happened, the series would have changed?
I think that for me personally, there was two series and two plays, and so we were up. I mean, because even when Paxson hit the three, we had they scored seven straight points. I think we were up six, but we called two plays in a row to get me the ball, and they doubled me with Scotty and Horace Grant, and I had to pass the ball two times in a row. We needed one more basket. And I couldn't get that one basket because, like I say, Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen are the two best defenders I've ever seen on the 4 or 5 position. And when they double you, and Michael's playing the free safety, I told somebody the other day, as good as that Bull team was with Rodman, and Rodman was a better individual defender, but Horace Grant was a better safety defender. So when you played against Michael and Scott and Horace, they were like free safety. If you didn't make the perfect pass, they were going the other direction. So I regretted the fact that I couldn't make one more play. I made the smart basketball play.
Right.
I always tried to make the smart basketball play. But those are the only two plays that I regret that series.
Yeah, you would have been roasted on First Take and on Undisputed for passing the ball. How dare you pass the ball in your double team to make the smart? I'm kidding.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, I got a lot of hatred for Skip Bayless, a lot of hatred because I don't think he's a good dude. And I think that I really just don't like him at all. And I'm thinking, like, you know, he always criticizing LeBron for making a good basketball play. I'm like, yeah, like Michael didn't pass the ball to Paxson or Steve Kerr where they made the final basket. Like, you always, you know, and it makes me mad when you hear, like, no, man, you make the proper back. Because, see, I'm smart enough to go back to what I was telling you earlier. Like, if I try to score on a double team and turn the ball over, they're going to say, see, he was trying to be the hero, and he took a bad shot or turned the ball over. See, I'm smart enough to understand how this whole thing works. I don't get caught up in what guys say on morning television because I know they're just trying to get clickbait. Like, if I try to score on two guys and I turn the ball over, I know how it works. Man, this guy trying to be the hero. He wants to make every big shot. But I'm saying, like, yo, man, I just saw Paxson pass MJ pass the ball to Paxson, which was a great play. And I just saw him pass the ball to Steve Kerr, which is a great basketball play.
The crazy thing about the Paxson thing was, I think he threw it up, what, to Scotty, and Scotty Pippen. Horace Grant had, I would say, probably, what, like a 5-footer he could have stepped in to almost lay it in. He didn't even look at the basket.
Hey, Doug, let me tell you something. I knew because I had scouted that play out because I had looked at tape earlier in the season. So the play was, I actually wasn't worried about anybody but Michael and Paxson. Because Paxson had some big shots against the Lakers in the playoffs. The rest of the guys, they wasn't going to shoot it. So the play was, he threw the ball to Scotty. So I jumped the play because I knew he was going to try to get the ball to Michael coming at us full speed, which is a nightmare. So I jumped to stop him from passing to Michael. Scotty could have had a layup or came close to shooting a layup, but he wasn't going to shoot it. He gave it to Horace, who probably had a layup or a little shot. The only mistake we made, because like I say, because I'm saying to myself, if these guys score, it's still a tie game, and we got the ball with 8-9 seconds to go. But we left a 3-point shooter because those other two guys were. I wasn't worried about those other two guys. Like, okay, even if they score, we got the ball. It's a tie score. But we did make a mistake leaving a 3-point shooter, and that was the mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. And Paxton obviously had done it again. That was the third straight year of doing it. Just, it seemed like that's how every series seemed to end. The next 2 years, you guys lost to the Rockets. And I know there was a documentary NBA TV did on the Rip City teams, because Jordan wasn't involved, because there was the OJ car chase, right? Because there's so much other stuff. How good were those Rockets teams in comparison to the Bulls teams?
I don't think they're as good as the Bulls team, but they had just an unstoppable weapon. That guy in Houston was able to, first of all, he had shots that were unguardable. He was great defensively. And they had a bunch of guys. They had Cassell coming off the bench, Vernon Maxwell, Kenny played well, Clyde Drexler played pretty good. But they just had that one guy that he was just so good offensively and defensively. And like I say, it was 2 7-game series. Hell of a series, too. But that was frustrating, those two losses.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, now I will get to the last couple of things. Basketball is in a weird place now. And you have, and when we got to work together and in watching you cover the NCAA tournament, you are a believer in the college system. On the other hand, it's not like you don't want players to get what they're worth and get what they're due when they get to the NBA, when they achieve things. You now have an option for some, we don't know how many, with the G League select team. You've had some guys go overseas. You have college sports, which they're giving kids more cost of attendance, and they're going to do some name and likeness stuff. If you had a son who's 16, 17 years old, what would you tell him about what he should think about, what he should worry about, how he should act, how, you know, like, because there's college, there's parents that listen to this and they'll say, well, Charles has lived all these different lives. What would you do?
Well, number one, I get mad when people tell young black kids getting a free education is a bad thing. It drives me crazy. I really do. It really drives me crazy when you tell black kids, like, oh, you're just getting an education. I'm like, yeah, that's a real deal. So that's the first thing that pisses me off. Secondly, we're only talking about a couple of guys. I mean, we're talking about a very small percentage of guys who are going to go on and make it in the NBA, like less than 1%. And now we're going to ruin the whole business model of all the other kids who are going to college and getting a free education. The likeness thing is interesting. I think it's going to build a lot of resentment between players, because only one or two guys going to be getting endorsements. Let's be realistic. Only one or two guys, and most guys ain't going to get endorsements or commercials or anything or sell their likeness. But one or two guys going to make, I don't know how much they're going to make, but there's going to be some resentment and jealousy in there. You know, let's take a college football team. Yeah, everybody going to buy the quarterback and the running back and the wide receiver jerseys. But if I'm a big, fat offensive lineman and I'm doing all the work for the quarterback and the running back and I'm not getting a dime, and my man's making an extra $300,000 in jerseys and he's got a card deal, you don't think I'm going to be pissed? Yeah, I'm going to be pissed. I don't like the G League model. I was wondering what the NBA's angle on that G League thing was. I'm thinking, like, first of all, you know they only announced one salary on one kid.
Yeah.
They said, well, we're going to pay this one kid $500,000. But the other kids, they're like, well, they're just going to sign with the G League. I'm like, I know they're not going to pay them all $500,000 because, you know, they always got an angle. And then I said, well, there's got to be another angle. I said, because if I'm a kid, it's better for me to go to Auburn, you know, Kansas, UCLA, Kentucky, Michigan State. A lot easier for me to go there and live there for 6 months where I got 3 meals a day. I'm going to be on national television 3 or 4 days a week. Or I'm going to Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I'm like, nah, the NBA is not going to put these studs in Fort Wayne, Indiana. No disrespect to Fort Wayne.
Right.
And then the thing come out about the select team. I said, oh, they're gonna cherry pick the best players and put them in L.A., a big city. Because I was like, wait a minute, they're not gonna take all these players and put them in these little crappy towns and play minor league and ride around on buses and fly around on coach. They're not going to do that. And I'm saying, no, I know the NBA well enough. They're not going to do that. And I said, oh, I see now. They're going to have a G League select. They're going to have other players who ain't going to make it in the NBA. They're going to have them playing in crappy cities. But the guys they think are top prospects, they're going to put them in a select team. And I'm saying, I knew they had an angle. It just took me a while to figure it out.
Yeah, I guess my issue, though, is that there's a bunch of different levels to it. One, I just believe that everybody needs a chance to be away from home, but not a professional, right? A true professional. That's a really hard, even if you're making $500,000, and even if you just need...
Doug, first of all, let's get one thing straight. That kid ain't going to make $500,000. He's going to make, by the time he pays his taxes, pays his agent, number one, they're going to put all those kids in L.A. You know how expensive it is in L.A. And, you know, they're probably going to have to bring a mom and dad and a bunch of other people with them. They're not going to send a 17, 18-year-old kid to L.A. And now that little $500,000 ain't going to be nearly enough for these kids. I mean, think about that. Like I say, once they pay their taxes, we're talking $250,000 somewhere in there. Like I say, you got to pay your agent. And now you're going to have to bring a bunch of people with you because, like, wait, I'm not sending my kid to L.A. and let him live by himself. So I'm bringing everybody. Now all that little chump change is gone. I'd rather send my kid to Calipari, Pearl, Bill Self, Roy Williams, Mike Krzyzewski for 6 months. We're only talking 6 months. I know my kid going to have a place to stay every day. He's going to get 3 square meals a day, and I ain't got to worry about his safety. That to me, is a better plan than this G League thing.
Well, the other part to it, though, is that there's different parts to it. One, they're going to play games, but they're more like exhibitions. Like, I want to know how you fit into a team. And a team structure, right? It's a delicate thing. Even if you're a superstar, walking into a team structure where other guys have played college basketball, you have not. Like, how do you deal with that? That's not something you have to do when you're on a G League select team. You just kind of play, and that's not what real basketball is. There's also no winning and losing. Like, learning how to win, as you pointed out at Auburn, right? Hadn't won in forever. You guys get to 500, then 15-13 your second year, then you win 20 games and go to the NCAA tournament your third year. Like, that learning, and not just learning how for you to win, but to get everybody else around you to win. We're like skipping steps on this thing in terms of what it's about.
I 100% agree with you. And like I say, are you going to turn these kids loose in L.A.? You're going to practice in the morning. Now they got all this free time. At least if you go to college for 6 months, you're in some type of structured environment. The parent, the mom and dad don't have to worry about you. I think that's a better model than select. Like I say, and also, you're going to have these other guys in the G League trying to kill these young kids. Like, oh, you're the number one high school player in the country. You know, I'm trying to feed my family, too.
Sure.
I'm coming for your head every single day. I'm trying to get to the league. I know the league is trying to make it where you can go, and we're going to prop you up on the elite team. But if I'm a guy playing on one of these other teams, like, oh, I'm playing against the number one player, quote unquote, in the draft, I'm going to get him. I mean, it just opened up a lot of stuff that I think is unnecessary. And let me tell you my biggest problem with it. Other than LeBron James, even Kobe Bryant and Kevin Garnett,
None of
these kids are ready for the NBA after 1 year of college. I would love to see them stay longer. I know that's not going to happen. But none of these kids are ready for the NBA right away anyway.
Why? You brought up the education. And there's no bigger factor in the socioeconomic structure of our country than education. It really divides how much you're going to make. And I find it fascinating that the original fight was for equal equal education. If you go back to segregation and when they finally put schools together, it was you're just trying to give somebody a fair shot and give them an equal education. We still aren't there with our public schools, elementary, middle, and high school. We're still not there. But this can even out some of the structure, right? Because if you get a college degree, your kids are more likely to get a college degree. You're more likely to live longer, be more educated, et cetera. The people you're around start more businesses. I kind of don't understand why there's not more successful African-Americans like yourself that understand that value of the education. They get kind of caught up in the, hey, we should be making more money immediately instead of kind of that long-term play. Why do you think that is?
Well, because unfortunately, our black kids are brainwashed to think they can only be successful through athletics and entertainment. You know, most of the famous people they see are athletes and entertainers. You know, Doug, one of the things that I've done, I just gave my $4 million to historically black colleges. There's four I've given $1 million to, and I'm like, none of this money goes to sports. This is strictly about black education. And when I meet with these kids and talk to them, I say, hey, no. We're not going to talk about Michael Jordan. We're not going to talk about LeBron. We're not going to talk about Jay-Z. We're going to talk about being doctors, lawyers, engineers, teachers, firemen, and policemen. And that's the thing I'm doing behind the scenes. But like I say, most of the black people these kids see, they're all rich and famous. And we have lost the perception of what a free education is. And that's why I keep railing against the system. You know, the NBA is going to cherry pick the best athletes. But like I say, they're such a small number. I wish, let me tell you something. The NBA, the NCAA, they're a bunch of bumbling fools. They're suspending guys for taking an extra pair of sneakers, suspending a guy for taking having lunch with somebody. Well, that's why they're asinine. We need to get some people running these sports who got a little bit more common sense. I mean, suspending guys because they get extra sneakers and extra benefits or a couple extra meals here or there, that's asinine and stupid.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, though. You bring up, like, the HBCUs. There was a movement in the 70s for some of the best high school players to play in the Ivy League, right? And the Ivy League in the 70s was like James Brown, of course, who's a famous broadcaster. Like, he was a great player at Harvard. And there was kind of that movement then. I do wonder why there's never been a movement for some of the best young black players. Like, look, if you're only going to go to school for a year, why not go to an HBCU? Right. Well, why not go there?
A couple of reasons. Number one, they don't have any money. They don't have great facilities. And you're not going to get the visibility. That's very simple. I mean, when I visit the four historically black colleges I gave $1 million to, they got awful facilities. But like I say, listen, how much notoriety did Zion get?
Yeah.
for six months at Duke? A lot of people thought he might be the number one draft pick, but after 6 months at Duke, he probably made an extra $200 million. And you got these guys talking about $500,000, which is chump change after taxes, and you start trying to live on. Zion made, like I say, the money he made at Duke, that's real money. Going to the G League and living in L.A. on $200,000 a year, and you got to bring everybody in your family with you, That ain't good to me. That's not a lot of money to me or you.
Can Zion become what you were?
You know, it's just, first of all, I think he's a lot more explosive. It just depends on the injuries. Hey, Doug, you've heard this 1,000 times. The best ability is availability.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of you. And you also do a good job of not taking, you were pretty explosive. I mean, maybe not as vertical as he was, but I mean, Sixer days, you were dunking on guys, especially after you lost weight, even before you lost weight, you were jumping to the moon. Does it simply come down to the weight for him in terms of his ability to be available?
You know, Doug, it's interesting. I don't know him. I root for him because he seems like a great kid. He doesn't look fat to me.
No.
So he might get, like I said, I want to know, he need to get with some serious professionals and see what the perfect weight for him to play at. Because it doesn't look like I say, it's just going to depend on his health. But he got a unique body, and man, he's explosive. So it's going to be fun to watch him in the next few years.
All right. Last thing, I've taken up way too much of your time. I think what's going to happen after this documentary is there's still going to be Team Jordan and Team LeBron guys, right? For whatever reason, I think political TV has made us to where we have to have one side of a debate, and that's where the sports TV has come into. But you've covered it, you've played it, you've done essentially everything you can do in terms of the world of basketball. Jordan, LeBron, are they so different you can't compare, or would you say Jordan is the best basketball player ever?
Well, for me, Doug, I've always said I thought Kobe Bryant was closer to Michael than LeBron. I think LeBron is closer to Magic.
Magic, yeah.
First of all, that's clearly not a knock. As far, if you want a guy who's going to kill you to win, Michael and Kobe are the guys. If you need a guy to make everybody around better, LeBron, Bird, and Magic, they're the guys. They're going to make everybody around them better. So I'm never going to say anything bad about LeBron because, number one, he's one of the greatest men we've ever had in the NBA. But that's the way I do it. Michael and LeBron, Michael and Kobe, they're just killers. They're going to do whatever it takes to win. They ain't worried about their teammates. They ain't worried about their friends. LeBron is going to be Magic and Bird. He's going to make the proper basketball play. If he has to score a lot, he's going to do it. If he has to rebound, he's going to do it. Or he's going to make sure Kyle Korver, Booby Gibson, he's going to make sure they get open for wide open threes. That's the difference in the guys, in my opinion.
You told the guys in Chicago that you and Mike still aren't close. You're not talking anymore because of it's only because of what you said about who he surrounds himself running the Bobcats, now the Hornets.
Doug, I really regret that because the clowns on the networks are talking about that, and they really pissing me off because, number one, we should not be having a conversation with two dudes not talking. We're not Prince Harry and William, you know. But yes, to answer your question, yes, but I'm really a little disappointed that the guys on the other networks are making this like they're having discussions. Like, number one, I want to apologize to Michael for even saying it because he don't have time for this crap. He's a new dad and he's running the Bobcat. Well, he's not doing anything right now. But I hate that they're trying to make it. It's just two dudes who had a disagreement. We can debate who's right or wrong, but I'm disappointed that they're trying to make it a big story.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're two of the greatest basketball players in the history of the sport. You were incredible friends. You know, you shared this bond of not only being teammates, but how many times you played golf together, you know, and I do think it's not like you said anything and you divulged any personal information, right? Like, it's one thing if you said something personal or you took a shot at him, but it's not necessarily a shot when you're doing your job. That's the part that's like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm pretty sure that, and you've been in the business a long time now, there's some guys who you like, who you probably said some things about, who got back to you, and that's just the way this business works, brother.
No question about it. But no one that I would say I have that long a stand. It's made some relationship, and I'm, you know, like I'm far less famous and successful than you are, and yet I've said plenty of shit that people don't like. And you know, I know coaches that will not come on shows me, will avoid me in person. I think it's different when you share that type of a bond and friendship. All right, last thing. I swear to God, it's the last thing. The golf swing, was it at any time smooth, and then there became this mental block? Like what? Or has it always been there since you started playing golf?
No, I used to be a great player. I used to be a single-digit handicap. I used to break 80 all the time. And then I got traded to Phoenix. I mean, I was like, hey, being an 8-9 handicap is not going to work out here against Dan Marley and these guys. So So I screwed up my swing, taking lessons from every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the world. And I don't know what's going on now, but I used to be a really good player. But I started taking too many lessons and messed up my swing.
It's crazy. The mind is so powerful. You know, mind is so
powerful.
Hey,
you know, it does. It's happened to better players than me. I mean, you look at, no disrespect to these guys, Ian Bacon Fitch had to quit because he got the driver yips. David DeBall was number one in the world, and he lost it. Like, I'm just glad it's not – I'm just glad I can still play and have fun. It drives me crazy sometimes, but, hey, man, mentally. Remember Chuck Knoblauch couldn't throw the ball from second base.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you get something mentally, and it's just over.
Have you tried hypnosis or –
Hey, Doug, that doesn't work. I just got a good night's sleep. I just got a good little power nap in. That sucked. I went to L.A. and got hypnotized, and all I did was get a good nap. It sucked. Wasted an hour of my day.
is there anything left to try to fix it? Like, are you just giving up? You're just like, this is
no,
who
I'm just going to play and have fun, smoke a couple cigars, have a few drinks, and relax.
Who introduced you guys to cigars? Who got, because you guys are all...
Michael's the first guy to start smoking cigars when we played golf back in the 80s.
And then who introduced him? I guess probably his dad, right? I think his dad was a smoker.
It might have been Amar Rashad. I'm not sure. Because those two guys I played golf with all the time who smoke cigars.
Charles, you're the best, man. Listen, I'm so glad
you're healthy. Hey, man, you take care of yourself and be safe.
All right, brother. Thanks so much.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, I want you to digest that. Feel free to tweet me out a question or a comment at Gottlieb Show. Hope you enjoyed it. You always enjoy Charles. I'll say this about Charles Barkley. He is a genuinely good person. He engages with you. He has that unique je ne sais quoi that allows him to lock in and remember little things about every person in the room. It's like senatorial. And yeah, do we at some point, at two different points in our life, can we contradict ourselves? Of course. But you grow and you mature and you learn different things, and sometimes your opinion changes. I think that would be my defense of Chuck if you think he's ever been hypocritical. He's not perfect, but who actually is? He's self-deprecating almost to a fault. And I every time I'm around him, the thing he talked about with Bird, Magic, and LeBron making people better, that's what Charles Barkley does in broadcasting. So my thanks to Charles for joining me. I'm Doug Gottlieb. Remember, you can listen to The Doug Gottlieb Show 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or SiriusXM channel 203 or 217. Thank you so much for downloading, listening, subscribing to All Ball.